Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hey, folks. It's nice to be back, and I hope you've missed us. We're your podcast team, and our guest today is Dr. Eitan Wein, who was graduated from the School of Medicine at Tel Aviv University in 1998, with training in pediatrics at Wolfson Medical Center in Holon, Israel, followed by specialty training in gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. There he also earned a PhD for studies in bacterially induced intestinal inflammation. His first position as an attending physician began in 2009 at the Stollery Children's Hospital in Edmonton, Alberta, where in 2021 he was appointed to a professorship of pediatrics at the University of Alberta. His academic interests have centered on the interplay among diet, enteral microbiome, and intestinal inflammation, but he hasn't chosen to talk to us about that today, but instead about the important clinical question of how to select initial therapy and how to progress to longer-term therapy in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, given the sometimes bewildering array of options in both testing and treatment. What are the best treatments, he asks, for pediatric inflammatory bowel disease in 2025? And when you come right down to it, how do we define best? How do we navigate a world with so many therapy options? How do we choose the best one for an individual patient? And finally, does the order matter in which we deploy the weapons in our armamentarium? Do we start with our most effective therapy or keep the big guns for the refractory cases only? All this, and with the access to new agents, the ground beneath us continues to shift, continues to quake. In any event, to specialize in the care of patients with inflammatory bowel disease requires substantial effort just to stay current. With a guide like Dr. Wein, however, one can be more confident that one is choosing well, as we hope this podcast demonstrates to you. Eitan, welcome.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here. And I might just add for my introduction that a very recent change, I have actually moved back to the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto 2 weeks ago after 16 years in Edmonton. So when I gave you my resume, I think that was not the case yet, but that's where I am now, and it's nice to be back. But the questions still remain the same, and they're still a very high gravity, and I hope we can try and provide some clarity around this complex issue.
For those of you who don't know Canada, don't know her provinces, don't know her weather, Alberta is the part of the world that they use to take the chill off the wind before it gets to North Dakota. Whereas in Toronto, at least down near London, they grow bananas. It's definitely a step up from Edmonton to Toronto, I would think.
Well, I think weather-wise, you're probably right, although that was not the main reason I moved, but certainly that is an additional benefit for sure.
Right. Let's move on to the question of whether there is an optimal sequence of biologic therapies for inflammatory bowel disease.
So one of the best answers to any question you ask is it depends. And I'm going to have to use that here too, but that's not me ending this podcast and saying goodbye, but rather just to highlight the point that there are patient factors that obviously have to be taken into account in any decision like that. And any advice that we give always has to be provided with that recognition that first of all, you know, the individual factors are important, but this also is a very dynamic and changing landscape that we're in. And I think that, you know, attempting to provide a simple answer would be obviously, you know, very helpful, but certainly not reflecting the reality completely. And the way we try and deal with this is probably through our guidelines. That's where we collect the data systematically and provide an answer to that. And if I had to give the shortest answer possible to that question, I'd say that for both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, if we've reached the stage where patients have failed the term, which is a bit problematic, conventional therapies, and we move to, again, a problematic term, advanced therapies, then probably anti-TNFs are our go-to in most cases. But what we'd probably like to explore in this discussion is what's beyond that and how we decide which therapy goes first. But I think that's a really good starting point for this discussion.
Well, you've set up the next point, and that is, well, where do we go from there?
So, as we're advancing in technology and we have new options that we have not had in the past, our life as physicians, as decision makers, or as those who are trying to guide our patients and families through that journey has become more complicated, because having no options makes life very simple, but it doesn't make it better. So certainly, you know, that burden of complexity is something that we embrace, and I think that we deal with that. And again, it's going to be matching many different factors into that decision process. And I think that if we try to break up what those factors could be, the most important one is probably efficacy. So which treatment is most efficacious? The second one would be safety. And a lot of the treatments we'll be discussing do have an excellent safety profile, but I think they still do differentiate from each other. And then the third component would probably be convenience, cost, regulatory approval, which is very important, and availability. Like certainly in Europe and across the world, not all these drugs are available. And if they are, they're not always available for the same indications. So that's kind of the background that we have to remember when we're approaching this and we are trying to make a decision.
But TNF, specifically after TNF, what comes next?
So the way to approach that, again, would depend, first of all, on what's available to us. We have to remember that currently the only drugs that are approved both in Europe and by the FDA in the USA, and as a result in many other countries, are the anti-TNFs. So that means that in some countries, others just aren't available. If we had a completely level playing field where all we needed to consider were number one, the efficacy, and number two, the safety, there certainly are alternatives that appear to be very attractive. And in the adult world, the ones that have arisen over the last few years are the integrin inhibitors such as vedolizumab, which has become quite popular for use in ulcerative colitis or in other colonic disease. And then ustekinumab, or more recently, the anti-IL-23 monoclonal antibodies, such as upadacitinib is one example, that have emerged for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis with very intriguing and interesting results in adults. And they both have the advantage of having what's considered an excellent safety profile, which is probably superior to what we're seeing with anti-TNFs. So that becomes a very attractive option. But at the same time, we're quite limited in our ability to compare how they operate compared to anti-TNFs. So one of the questions that we might want to address is, should these be offered before anti-TNFs? But if we are looking at what we can offer if TNFs have failed, I think those are the options that we might want to consider, at least at the initial stage. However, I'll just add one component, which I think is important. Before we do decide to proceed with a change in medication in a different class, it's always wise to make sure that we're optimizing the therapy of the treatment that we have decided has failed, because maybe it's not the therapy that's failed, it's our failure to provide it in the most optimal way.
Practical considerations then coming to the fore. You're in Canada, and do you have access to those, quote, third generation, close quote, agents that you were just mentioning, the monoclonal antibodies?
So again, it is a changing landscape, and Canada is one country, but across the different provinces in Canada, there is variability in the access.
Now that I didn't know.
It's true that the complexity there is more than we'd like it to be. And, you know, some things that I've been able to do in Alberta now until recently, I can't always do in Ontario. So that is important. And I think it reflects what we're going to see across the world. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, and I think this is true for many countries, if we can justify the use of a drug that is not approved, not licensed for use, then we can usually still get access to that drug with certain limitations. And the different players in this decision are the regulators, the funders of the drug, and that will vary from country to country, and in many cases, the pharmaceutical companies who are asked to provide some drugs on compassionate basis, where it may not be approved yet, but they are willing to participate. And this depends a bit on the relationship that we develop with those companies, where we're able to say that, you know, we have to help these children. That's an important factor. But at the same time, we want to do it in a responsible and safe way. And it ends up being an individual request in some of these cases where we have to make the case. And I think it's good practice for any one of us, sometimes provided by support in literature, why this off-label treatment is required for this case. So a scenario where we can just automatically use whatever we want is not, unfortunately, quite available yet for many of us. But we do have criteria that we fill where we do say, this is a treatment we need, and we are able to achieve it in many cases for the drugs that I did mention so far.
In your case, or in your particular practice, does this access to off-label treatments include a pledge to report the results?
So it's not built into the process itself. There certainly is a post-marketing surveillance of drug use that some of the companies do enforce or request. But for many reasons, including confidentiality, we do not commit to providing this information to the drug companies automatically. But many of us are very invested into research, and we have national or local databases that we maintain. We consent patients, and we've been doing this. We have a network in Canada for the study of pediatric IBD, where we try to recruit all our patients, especially if they're using advanced therapies, to our network database. And for example, at this meeting, we have taken advantage of some of that. And I just came from an abstract session where Tom Walters from Toronto did report some of our Canadian experience on the use of ustekinumab. And that's thanks to our ability to recruit patients to these studies and the value that we see in complementing randomized controlled trials, for example, with some studies that are based on registries or other collection in the lack of good data that we live in, unfortunately, in this scenario.
Let's talk about the idea of using these monoclonal antibodies earlier in the process, in the, let's call it the drug ladder.
Yeah. So that, I think that term is very legitimate, because that's the way we act in many cases. And I think that the terminology of stepping up therapy is certainly there. But to even, you know, make your question a bit more focused, I think, should we be starting at the top of the ladder? And certainly the top-down approach that has been around for a couple of decades at this point, saying that, you know, we should start with our strongest therapy from the beginning, is relevant. And certainly there's quite a bit of research showing that hitting the disease hard, quote unquote, at the beginning is likely to reduce the risk of deterioration and progression of disease and complications, surgery, et cetera, down the road. However, are we willing to sacrifice not only the financial costs, but also the risk of overtreating patients with treatments that might be risky and might be painful, et cetera? And what about those who don't need all of that therapy? So this is something we struggle with a bit. One way of looking at it is really identifying those who need the more advanced therapy early on, and there's a lot of effort into that. But another way is identifying those who may actually not need that therapy and starting them on, you know, a lower step in the ladder. And just to add to that even more, there are a couple of very intriguing studies in adults where they're actually starting with two biologics at the beginning and then finding a path to stop one of them, really trying to get more out of that. And this is something I think we're going to be seeing more and more of as time goes by.
What tools can you bring in to assess susceptibility or the likelihood that a patient will respond to a particular class of agents?
So again, there are a lot of efforts looking into that, and I would divide those into two main categories. So there are clinical predictors of response to therapy, and generally speaking, a patient who has more severe presentation at the beginning with more burden of disease, more extensive disease, higher scores that we use, such as the PCDAI and PUCAI score, elevated fecal calprotectin, more findings on ultrasound, etc., are likely to benefit from heavier or more advanced therapy at the get-go. And then a very important supplement to that is the initial response. So close monitoring and the ability to determine whether a patient is responding in a satisfactory way is important, because if they're not, then we have to escalate therapy and quite quick. The other category would be biochemical or other laboratory predictors. And this, for the last 10 years, I think, has been where everyone has felt the big answer can come from. Could genetics, could the microbiome, could the metabolome, transcriptome provide us with that information? There have been very expensive and elaborate studies that have looked at that. And unfortunately, most of them have been disappointing. So I think we're not quite at the point where we could provide a molecular level guide into which treatment to use first. So it is mostly a clinical decision.
Then the question that occurs to me is, you've just moved from Alberta to Ontario. What do you hope to accomplish there? How do you mean to undertake your projects? And what insights do they give us into how this field may take shape over the next 10 years?
I think the two main aspects that will lead us forward are collaboration and advocacy. And being at the ESPGHAN meeting right now has really shown me so much of the knowledge that's out there and the work that we can do together at the local and global level in both of those efforts. So collecting our data in a large, in, you know, seeing the big picture and trying to come up with projects where we can work together to use the best data we can to make decisions is one aspect.
And but I think that's not particularly Toronto specific.
No, it isn't. That's true. But, you know, I still think that being in a position where I'm at a large center with many international connections that I bring with me and others as well, we are well positioned to do that. And then the other aspect of advocacy, in my eyes, is critical. And I discussed the fact that a lot of these drugs are not labeled for pediatrics, not approved. So there are advocacy efforts now going on locally and internationally to try and change that and allow for extrapolation of drugs so we can have better access to them and use what we know medically to be correct at the clinic level as well.
Now you're talking there, I think, mostly about access to agents that are deployed at the moment in adults, but not yet in kids.
Correct. And some of those drugs have been approved for more than a decade for use in adults and are not yet approved in pediatrics.
What's the hitch there?
Oh, that's a very big question. So
I'll start at the beginning, go to the end, then stop.
Okay. I'm glad you have great solutions, at least for answering the question. I think that the natural concern that regulators have around use of drugs in pediatrics and wanting to keep our children safe is motivated for all the right reasons, but it's holding back in providing the treatment for our patients. And having extra regulations for children are appropriate, but these have to be assessed in the setting where we do need to provide therapy. And doing it the way I described before, where we have to go begging to the drug companies, please give me your drug, is not the right way to do it. Mm-hmm. So this should be done in a way where experts define what the correct indications are for these different treatments and are able to provide it without the need for working the system to make it happen.
Would you like to address any other classes of drugs that might be in the pipeline or might already be out there?
So there definitely are many more drugs that are worth mentioning. I think one category that we didn't mention at all is the JAK inhibitors. These are small molecules. Okay. And their role is certainly increasing significantly in ulcerative colitis, for example. Tofacitinib and upadacitinib are fitting in a lot early in the algorithms, including when drugs have failed early on. And I think that, you know, we are gaining experience. At the meeting again, there were some reports on the use of upadacitinib that I think are really intriguing. And as time goes by, I imagine that we'll be using that a lot more. And small molecules, of course, have the advantage of also being oral medications. Another category is the S1P modulators, which will impact the trafficking of leukocytes within lymph nodes and have a more broad impact on the immune system. There are some safety concerns that I think have to be considered in that setting. But again, oral drugs working through a different mechanism that are attractive. And probably the being at the adult meetings, one of the latest interesting categories are the anti-TL1A molecules that work on a very different immune regulatory pathway that might be quite promising. It will take some time until we see this in pediatrics, but I'm encouraged by the fact that there are more and more players entering the scene.
Thank you very much for this. Well, it's a bit of a take your breath away perspective, and there's so many strands to try to weave into a coherent whole. I'm not certain that I've accomplished it just by listening, but I trust that by consulting the references that you've provided, I'll make some progress. At least I hope I will.
I hope so too, and I have not expected to provide, you know, simple, practical answers for all of these, but I hope that some of the principles that we discuss will be helpful and will encourage people not only to read and look at the references, but to open their minds and do more research and help advance this field.
Thank you again, sir. And we need one last thing before I send you on your way, and that is the song that you'd like to contribute to the Espigan Favorite Songs Spotify playlist.
That's a very exciting task you gave me there. And I think just coming down from seeing the world map and the attendance at this meeting, and myself as well, having the origins in different places and spending time in different places, I think We Are the World is the choice for me as a song.
Great. So, and again, good luck in Toronto.
Thank you very much.